This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Caroline Menville Alonso is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. And in studio is Mary Olive Pearson, the veteran attorney and the person who knows this town, Capital Region, better than just about anybody alive. She has been in her game for a while, and yesterday she was in the courtroom, a place she's quite familiar with. The judge overseeing the legal fight over the creation of a new city of St. George in southeastern East Baton Rouge Parish rejected a request by supporters to rule on several of the arguments made by the new city's opponents, which would have expedited the trial. Lawyers representing East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom and Mayor Pro Tem Lamont Cole, who are suing to stop the city's creation, argue that St. George fails to meet the legal requirements to become a city, even though voters in a narrow vote chose to create one, the voters in St. George, because they say it lacks a concrete plan to provide critical services to its residents, such as law enforcement, sewage, and drainage. So the beat goes on, and Mary Olive Pearson, does that mean we have a trial that will come very soon?
Well, what it means is, the judge in the case retired. Judge Morvant retired. And so now we have an ad hoc judge who's retired, but he's been appointed for, I guess, the next 3 or 4 months. And he was here yesterday. His name is Martin Cody. He's from St. Tammany Parish. He was very attentive yesterday and obviously served a meaningful career as a judge over in St. Tammany Parish. The hearing yesterday was to determine whether or not, on behalf of the St. George supporters, they had filed a motion for partial summary judgment on some of the issues in the case. And it boiled down to this, in layman's terms. You want a city or you want part of a city? They wanted a judgment that it was okay for them to have about 5 services, but there were 8 other services that they said, well, we might provide those. You know, and not only we might provide them, if we have enough money. And then the petition that they circulated to the people to sign and get them to sign, encourage them to sign, didn't have any information on it about, well, how much money will you need, and are you going to have it, and where is it going to come from? And unfortunately, and there will be another motion for summary judgment filed next week by the plaintiffs, that would be my clients, to address one issue in the case. The law requires that on the face of your petition that circulated for signatures, mm-hmm. you give your plan. They have the two proponents of the two organizers, Mr. Riles and Mr. Browning, although they're very sincere, and I'm sure that they, you know, are well-meaning, they have admitted there's no plan on that petition. And so without that, since the law requires that, the judge in the case has to decide whether or not the petition that was circulated, and this is a quote, fully complies, end quote, with the statute. Without the plan, it doesn't comply at all.
All right, so the next step could be the end of the trail, or it could be the beginning of a... Of a new trail and a new trial, which could happen in April.
The trial could be either, we have two trial dates. We have a trial date in April and a trial date in May. The trial date in April is dependent upon the schedule of one of the attorneys who told the judge at the time there's an out-of-country situation trip going on. And so if that doesn't take place, the trial will be in May. It's not an issue now. Those are set dates. But what we have is an ad hoc judge and an election, which is going to coincide with those trial dates practically, because the election to get a permanent judge in that seat is March the 26th and April the 30th. So at some point, that's going to become an issue to be resolved.
Well, you and the opponents have argued that creating the new city will slash the tax base for Baton Rouge and that the city of St. George is not up to snuff as far as providing services for the people in the community. Now, is that something that is enough to get a summary judgment to just throw the whole thing out?
It's enough if their plan to do what you're talking about is not on the face of that petition. They say that that plan is on a website, but there's no identification on their petition about where that website is. The other thing is this. Here's the problem without a plan. If they take, and it, the number that's been thrown around is $48 million out of the city parish budget, and if they then don't provide the services that they say they might not provide, mm-hmm. it's going to fall back on the city parish and the taxpayers that don't live in the city of St. George to pay for the services for the people in the city of St. George. Well, that's why they have to have a plan.
You're a partisan, and of course you're a hired gun, but what do you think the next move will be? What's your gut tell you?
Well, our next move is to file a motion for summary judgment next week. The deadline to do so is a week from today, but we're going to file it, I think, a couple of days ahead of that and have that hearing. It could be the end of the case. And if not, then I guess we'll, you know, go forward to the April and May trial dates.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this before, but people who are supportive say, look, we played by the rules. We got the people in the area to vote for it. And then, of course, others say they cut out Gardier, and, of course, it should have been a parish vote, which it probably should have. But the rules in place at the time enabled them to win, albeit by a small margin, of those who were in that area. Now, what do you say to those who say you're trying to change the rules at not only the middle of the game, but the end of the game?
That is a false representation of the statute. We are not contesting the fact of the election and that whatever number of people voted that they wanted to incorporate. But the same statute that allows them to have that election mm-hmm. is the statute that says after the election, in 30 days, if someone authorized to do so files a lawsuit challenging their ability to form the city, not whether they want it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I might want a mansion that costs $10 million, but if I don't have the money, I can't build it. And Section 4 of the same statute that they're talking about says if the lawsuit is filed, the judge gets to decide, the judge has to decide, does it fully comply with all of the provisions of the statute, not just the one that says you have an election.
Is this some noise in the background that we obviously have a divided country and we have a divided community? Is this perpetuating that? This dilemma that's ongoing, and this is 3 years now since the vote.
Well, it's 3 years since the vote. It's 8 years since they started talking about dividing the city. And do I think that it divides the city? Yes, I do. And it did. People say, well, you know, you got Zachary and you got Baker and you got Central. Those are small little rural communities. This is 86,000 people mm-hmm. in the largest geographic, commercial, urban area of this city. I guarantee you that if I looked around, I'm not going to find any six-lane highways in Central, Zachary, or Baker. But you will find mm-hmm. them out there in the area that they proposed for St. George. And everybody in this parish since 1949 has contributed to those. So we have paid for that, and they just want to take it to themselves and divide the place.
And some of these places, of course, are no longer part of St. George. They found a way to get out.
Well, if you live on the, what they propose to be the border, and that border is bordering on the city of Baton Rouge, you can annex yourself to the city of Baton Rouge, and a lot of people have done so.
877-217-5757, and I've got some emails, and we will go to the phone lines, and usually if you call, you're going to go ahead of the emailers, but one asks about the Mall of Louisiana. That's no longer part of it, is it? Hasn't that been annexed out of it?
The mall is, it's yes and no. The mall has been annexed, yes. Some of the individual stores have not.
Okay, Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana. Henry, good morning.
Hello, Mr. Jim. Hello, Miss Sally. I hope y'all are having a great day. One thing that they don't want to talk about, the St. George people don't want to talk about, this thing came up for an election the first time, or for a petition the first time, and it didn't fly. So what do? They cut out predominantly African-American areas so that the proposed St. George would be a far whiter area, and lo and behold, they get it passed. But they don't want to talk about this being a racist move. I'd appreciate if y'all could address that. Thank you.
All right. Is Henry on to something?
Well, I think so. Look, you look at the map that they drew in 2014, which was the first petition that failed because it didn't get enough signatures, and you look at the map that they drew in 2018, and even the proponent, even the incorporators that they've appointed have admitted, yes, we cut out those areas, and it's the Gardere area, predominantly minority.
We're back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Mary Olive Pearson with us for a bit longer, the veteran attorney, and let's go to Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Patricia, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks. I have two questions. First one is, it seems like it's been a long time since the election, and it seems like your objection to the petition that they didn't include the correct information is fairly simple. So I was wondering, first, what took so long to bring that up? And then second, is this proposed city of St. George taking legal action against the neighborhoods and businesses that are trying to get out of it? Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Patricia.
Well, to answer your first question, Patricia, about why it took so long, there were several appeals during the last couple of years of different rulings by the court. We didn't take any of them. At St. George, people took some appeals from some what they thought were adverse rulings, and they were affirmed. So, and that took a while. Second, we had to have discovery, which we took depositions and the usual thing that I know people complain that lawyers do, but, you know, that's why it took so long. And now we have a deadline of next Friday to file dispositive motions, and that the next one will be filed. The other question is, why are they challenging the annexations? I have no clue. I mean, if somebody wants to, I think that people ought to have a choice where they want to live. My problem from Jump Street, I call it, is that they drew this map with this line creating the boundaries, and I'm supposedly in the proposed city of St. George. Nobody asked me if that's where I wanted to be. And if I could, I would annex myself to the city, but I don't think I'm on the border.
Did you vote?
I did.
Okay. Well, you were asked at the ballot box. About 14,000 people, almost all black, were carved out of the proposed city, and based on the final tally, that might have made the difference in the election.
There's no question it would have. But, they've admitted that they cut out, it's actually about, I think, 13,200 people in the Gardere area. And they admitted in their depositions, the two organizers, that's who they cut out. But they had a different excuse. They said that it's because they were going to vote against them. Well, yeah, okay.
Okay. All right, let's get to a few. We've got some people fired up, ready to talk to Mary Olive. Doug on I-10. Hi, Doug. You're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning. Let's go to Doug. Caroline on line 4. Can you do it? There we go. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good morning. I, too, am in one of the areas that would be incorporated, and I've voted against it, but I don't want to live there. But anyway, one of the concerns is that, and you've touched on the all indications, they vastly underestimated the costs of creating what they say they can create at a lower cost than the present city of Baton Rouge. And part of that picture is that it's the most flood-prone part of the parish. And that means that unless they're going to replicate a lot of the mistakes that Baton Rouge has made for allowing development of those areas, they're going to need to prevent development of the areas that are going to flood, which will reduce further the revenue. Or I guess they could just allow them all to be built in, which will then cause cost from flooding. So.
All right. Thank you, Doug. Mary Olive?
Well, my response to that is, yes, they've not only underestimated the cost, the cost is supposed to be put on the plan, which is supposed to be on the petition, which it wasn't. But one of the items that they list in their list of things that they may provide if they have enough money is drainage maintenance. I've often wondered, you mean to tell me that that's an option for this new city, that we might take care of the ditches, we might take care of the drainage? But that's what they've said that they might do. Mm-hmm. And they're only going to do it if they have enough money, but they haven't told the people that signed the petition, how much money are you going to need?
Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, you're on with Mary Olive Pearson.
Hey, you know, I'm against the St. George thing. It's more government. I get it. But the whole reason for this, it's the same reason why your political party is supporting Mixon over Gary Chambers. People want to send their kids to schools where they themselves have, where the other parents have the same values as they have. They don't want to send their kids to a school where the parents don't care. And all this is because of the teachers' unions. We need to convert to vouchers, enable parents.
All right. Patrick's rambling, but he's passionate about this, and I'm surprised he's against it, but he says he's against it, and he says the reasons are educationally based. Is that what precipitated this?
They have admitted that the formation of an independent school district is really their primary goal. But I need to tell the listeners to understand this. The city parish and the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board are two different governments. This lawsuit is about forming a city. And whether they get a city or not, there are some additional steps if they want a school. But now, if they want a separate school, this lawsuit is not going to resolve that problem for them. And to be quite frank, if they want a separate school, there's a way to do that without forming a new city. But they haven't tried that yet.
All right, Stuart downtown. Stuart, you're on with Mary Olive.
Jim, Mary Olive in the audience, as always, good morning. Ms. Pearson, doesn't the city parish form of government exist ultimately because of white flight? Secondly, hasn't litigation been fought before to abandon this form of government? And how do you think all this stuff is going to wind up playing out?
All right, Mary Olive. Thank you, Stuart.
Your first question was about white flight. I mean, I don't really understand the question, but I will tell you this. The area proposed to be St. George, I've read articles about it, and when they cut out the Gardier area, which with Gardier there was 22% minority representation, without it there was 12. So it is a predominantly white area. So I guess if you want to support white flight, this would be the way to do it. But that's not what I would be looking for. And second of all, our consolidated form of government, to my knowledge, we've had it since 1949, and I don't think it's been attacked.
Well, and even if this were to happen, Sharon Weston Broome would still be mayor president of St. George, as well as she is any other entity in the parish. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Yes, sir. You know, the thing about this is that it affects so many people, and I don't believe that enough people got to vote on it, and I don't think the vote would have gone their way if more people were allowed to weigh in on it. And the other thing is, you know what? You got to raise taxes to do stuff.
All right. What a
Well, you're preaching to the choir when you talk about not enough people voted on it. Unfortunately, the statute says that the only people that get to vote are the ones that are in the proposed area. I believe that, I have tried to get people to introduce legislation. If you're going to make this big of a change in a consolidated form of government, I think that everybody in the consolidated form of government, which is everybody in the parish, ought to be allowed to vote.
All right. Laverne in Mid-City. Laverne, you're on with Mary Olive. Hi, Laverne.
I work in one of those schools in the St. George area, and we don't teach values. Values are done at home. We teach subjects that are supported by standards. And, you know, the students that make up those schools in the St. George area benefit from having a racially diverse community. We have a school that is probably about 40% white, 30% Latino and another 30% African-American. And we're an A school. And the reason that we're an A school is we have amazing teachers.
Mary Olive?
I can't argue with that. I mean, I think that you're correct. And I haven't done an examination of the diversity of the schools, excuse me, that are physically located in the St. George proposed area. But if what you're saying is correct, and I agree, by the way, you don't teach principals at the, excuse me, at the school, you teach subjects.
877-217-5757. We will spend a few more minutes with Mary Olive Pearson, and as promised, we will get her review of the failure this week in the Senate to get a voting rights bill through the hoops. Also, Mary Olive may have some comments about other matters of politics near and far. She has been at this game for a while. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And we'll also hear from Dr. Mark Vonnegut. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. On deck is Dr. Mark Vonnegut, eldest son of the great writer Kurt Vonnegut. Mark is a pediatrician. He's been at his game a long time and has an amazing backstory and a new book, and we'll talk with him in a moment. We're wrapping it up with Mary Olive Pearson. Keith in Sherwood Forest, I know you've been waiting patiently, and I'll slide you in before we go to Mark. Keith, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, good morning, Jim and Ms. Pearson. I appreciate your input on this very important subject. I wonder if you could speak to this for me. I'm not sure I've heard a clear explanation as to why this area has remained unincorporated and why the city hasn't just incorporated it, some or all of it, at some point in the past.
I'm going to guess apathy because I really don't know. We have annexed various portions of the unincorporated area, and I can't explain that. I mean, it's just, it's historical. They haven't done it. And it would be a good thing.
Now, last time you were on this show, you talked about voting rights and talked about your experience as a voter when you registered. It wasn't pleasant, was it?
Well, it was 60 years ago, too. I mean, when I was 18. So that ought to tell you, if you can do your math. I'll be 78 in a couple of weeks. Well, yeah. But anyway.
Lost a step.
I had to take a test to vote, and I was told there were two tests. There was one for me because I was white, and there was one for other people who were not white. And so I guess I passed the white test. I don't know. But I did get registered to vote, and I've been voting ever since.
Well, what do you think of the Senate not doing what some people believe they should have on the voting rights bill? And our two senators, Cassidy and Kennedy, both voted against it. Your thoughts?
My thoughts about how the Senate is behaving in the 202 area code, which for your listeners is Washington, D.C., the way they're behaving is abominable. And to me, how do you even muster up the courage to say, I want to restrict somebody else's right to vote, and they're a citizen just like I am? I don't know how you do that. Why don't they just vote against apple pie?
All right, now. Our producer, Caroline Menville Alonso, is frantically trying to find this piece of tape. Well, hold on. I think she found it. A listener wants you to respond to this question. You just mentioned your age. Biden is a year older than you, year and a half, and people are questioning his mental acuity. And and this guy from Newsmax actually had the audacity to ask the president of the United States this at the news conference, a two-hour news conference the other day. Here's how it sounded.
Of registered voters disagreeing with the statement, Joe Biden is mentally fit. Well, not even a majority of Democrats who responded strongly affirmed that statement.
Well, I'll let you all make the judgment whether they're correct.
Well, the question I have for you, sir, if you'd let me finish, is why do you suppose such large segments of the American electorate have come to harbor such profound concerns about your cognitive fitness? Thank you.
Is that a cheap shot?
I have no idea.
He says, I have no idea. He answered it appropriately, by the way.
I have an idea.
Yeah.
These people have been duped by things on what I call anti-social media. They read things on Facebook. They have no idea where it comes from. They read all this, these tropes coming from these people that, you know, they do all kind of things about, you know, vaccines kill you or whatever they want to say. I can't explain why people believe what they believe. People still believe that the 2020 election didn't go to Biden. How do you do that when I think 60 lawsuits said that he's the president? I just, you know, maybe they're just morons. I don't know how they come to those conclusions.
Well, thank you, Mary Olive. Let's do it again soon. You're always a delight. Keep
let me add this. Don't anybody call in and ask about my mental acuity because I'm 78.
Well, you're doing well. And I have a feeling you've got some miles to travel, lots of gas left in Mary Olive's tank.
Thanks.
And with us is another guy who's a survivor and has written about his backstory a few times. And he's back with another book about his life as an American pediatrician, Mark Vonnegut. The name is familiar because he's the son of the fabulous writer Kurt Vonnegut, the man who gave us Slaughterhouse-Five. And he is the brother of Edith Vonnegut and Nanette Vonnegut. He describes himself in the preface of his 1975 book as a hippie, a son of a counterculture hero, a BA in a religion with a genetic disposition to schizophrenia. And he has spent a career in the medical world as a pediatrician. His latest work is The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics, with Seven Stories Press that is just out. And this is a man who, in addition to everything else, is a well-respected physician. Good morning, Mark Vonnegut.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the latest work, and you have logged a life. You're now past the age of 70 as well, and it has been a remarkable life for you in the spotlight and in these rooms where there is no spotlight, but amazing stories evolve, and you tell some of those. You help for people young in life who have challenges, and sometimes those are profound and compelling, and they have affected your worldview. Tell us more.
Well, my stories, I think, tell of a change from a time when patients and doctors and hospitals had a lot more choice. And I think people wonder what's gone wrong with medicine, and I think it is the lack of choice, which leads to the lack of value and service, and burned out patients, and people with broken hips spending 3 days in emergency rooms.
And some of these kids make it, some don't. How does that affect you?
I am a big crybaby. I don't do well. I remember the patients who don't do well. I spend a lot of time with them and their families, and I don't think there's anything worse than losing a child.
We're visiting with Mark Vonnegut. If you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757, joining us from Quincy, Massachusetts. A remarkable pediatrician, and that's the story of his latest book, The Heart of Caring. But for those familiar with his backstory, more than 50 years ago, Mark was diagnosed with severe schizophrenia, and you were committed to a hospital, but you overcame that. That had to be a searing moment in your life.
It certainly was. I came out of that desperately wanting to be something other than somebody with mental illness. And I think I partly had a chip on my shoulder, which made me want to go to medical school and be of service. And I got lucky and have been able to do that.
A listener who knows something about your backstory, Hal in Monroe, asked you to elaborate on how you avoided military service during the Vietnam era, and you're of an age where you were smack dab in the middle of that, like three presidents who didn't serve, at least didn't serve
right.
In wartime. Your thoughts?
What happened was I went to do the physical, and I was at that point upset about the nation's policy and the war. And I told people how I felt, and I was declared unfit for military service. I was given a 4F, and I used no political power or anything to do that. I think in a more just war, I would have been a fine soldier, but it was the opinion of the armed services that I was not good soldier material.
How was it growing up with a famous parent? And when I say famous, there are levels of fame, and in the literary world, your dad was at the top of his game.
He absolutely was, but when I was growing up, he was somebody who tried and failed to be a car salesman, who couldn't get a job teaching English at Cape Cod Community College, and at one point borrowed $100 of my paper route money. So he, like a lot of artists and writers, did not have an easy time of it. And I think fame is hard on the individuals, and I think it's hard on the families. But I grew up not feeling, I wasn't the son of a famous man. I became the son of a famous man in my 20s.
Yeah, you were born right after World War II, and that, of course, is the source of a lot of your dad's most profound writing. But your parents knew what they were dealing with. I think you were named after Mark Twain, weren't you?
Yes, and I'm glad they didn't actually give me the middle name. That would have been no fun. So, but the Mark did come from Mark Twain.
Now, did your experience as a kid, Mark, Dr. Vonnegut, did that make you the man you are as far as this life in pediatrics, which some people would say that, wow, that is quite an experience based on your growing up years. You segued into something many wouldn't have thought you would do, Harvard Medical School, and that's pretty serious stuff.
And as I say often, I got lucky. I think certainly part of going into pediatrics is the feeling I could have used a good pediatrician growing up. And the love of taking care of kids in medical school. You get a chance to take care of all sorts of people and be with all sorts of doctors. And I quite simply liked working with children and their resilience and their desire to make connections with doctors. And I like pediatricians. They seem to me the most cheerful doctors that I ran into.
Hold tight. We're going to spend a few more minutes with Mark Vonnegut. The book is The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. On deck is Amy Herman, founder and president of The Art of Perception. She has a remarkable book, too. It's called Fixed, and we will talk with her in short order, but we're wrapping it up with Mark Vonnegut, another accomplished doctor and author, and he has written about his life in The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics. But some listeners have forwarded me some emails at talk@talklouisiana.org, and one of them is Slaughterhouse 5, 1969. You were 22, and your dad was 47 when that book came out, and, and it changed the world of the whole family. Did you know what you were dealing with? Or did you have a feeling that this was going to make your dad a household name?
You know, I didn't, and from my point of view, it was not a good thing. I didn't understand how we had gone from being a struggling family to being a relatively wealthy family in such a short period of time. When the money hit, I was out of the house, and I was sort of looking back at my family and saying, where did all these rich people come from? They were taking trips to Europe and things that had been unthinkable to me as a child.
And
I didn't like the idea.
And you were dealing with your own issues and your book in 1975. Now, mind you, the Eden Express, Mark's book, came just 6 years after Slaughterhouse 5, but it is now widely cited as useful for those coping with schizophrenia. And another listener asked a pertinent question on how you have dealt with your bipolar disorder.
I've had good help. I've had It's always a combination of things. I had a good hospital. I had good doctors. I had good medication. I had good support from my family. I was just lucky in many ways. And I think the problem in mental illness in general, and we're certainly in a crisis right now, is not enough of all those things. I don't think we have enough therapists. I don't think we have medications used in the right ways. I don't think it's so it's always a combination of things.
And we're wrapping it up. We only have a few seconds to go with Mark, but Mark Vonnegut, the book is The Heart of Caring. Dominic and Grand Coteau, let's slide you in quickly. Dominic, you're on with Mark.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Ben. Good morning. Mark, Dr. Vonnegut, sir, what do you think of the parents that will not allow their children to wear masks to school or even get the vaccine in the middle of a pandemic?
All right. Legitimate question, Mark. Your thoughts about parents who do not, we got to get Mark back on, Caroline. What about parents who refrain from having their children wear masks? Did we lose Mark? Yes, sir.
There,
yeah. Okay, please.
I think we have done very poorly with the pandemic, and it astounds me how easily we as a nation can polarize and politicize anything. And I think most parents and most kids want to be protected, and they want to protect their families, and they want to protect their grandparents. But the people, I don't think they're bad people. They're good parents. They just are misinformed by their families, by the internet, and they think it's possible that the immunization will be a bad thing for their children. There's overwhelming evidence that the chance of serious side effects from the immunization are about 1 in 500. The chance of being hurt or having somebody in your family hurt by COVID is unfortunately much higher.
Thank you, Dr. Mark Vonnegut, quite a man and quite a story in his latest book, The Heart of Caring, A Life in Pediatrics.
Thank you very much.
We're joined now by Amy Herman. Her book is Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. She's founder and president of The Art of Perception, a New York-based organization that conducts professional development courses for leaders around the world, from Secret Service agents to prison wardens. And Amy has an amazing backstory. And this is a absolutely beautiful book. The presentation is amazing, and you would expect it for a person who is an art historian and an attorney, holding a BA from Lafayette College, a JD from the National Law Center at George Washington U, and an MA in art history from Hunter College. Now, that may explain why you're better at problem solving than the rest of us, Amy, is that you have such a diverse background. Not many people have that right brain, left brain going so intuitively as you do, but it's something you write about. Tell us how we can fix things better than we do now.
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for having me on the show. You know, as I was listening to your introduction, I was thinking, all that education, I've done 99.9% of my learning working with the audiences that I have. I've learned so much from them. And really what I've done, I find art to be very powerful. I love it. But all I've done is channel the power of that art to help people do their jobs more effectively. I want them to see art as not just something that hangs on museum walls, but something that we can use in our everyday lives. And as I've outlined in this book, how we can use it to solve problems. Because as you were just saying in your last piece, we are just faced with problems up, down, sideways, right, and left. And so I've just really taken the idea, because I'm a lawyer and an art historian, I say I've made a professional peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I've taken legal analysis and visual analysis and put them together to create this program where I train people to look at art.
Well, since you mentioned peanut butter and jelly, there's a story you tell about addressing an audience, and tell us more about peanut butter and jelly.
Yes, well, I also have to thank you for the kind words about the book. I put a lot of thought into the cover, which I can tell you
Well, go ahead. Yeah, it is beautiful.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll try to give a visual description since we are on the radio. But I do these programs globally, or I did before the pandemic, I should say. And, you know, we take for granted some images. We just know what they are. We think we know what we're looking at, and we think everybody who looks at them thinks the same way we do. And I had a real wake-up call. I was in the UK doing a session of my program, and I showed a photograph by Alex Soth, one of my favorite photographs, and it shows a National Guardsman in his uniform, and I believe it's in North Carolina, and he's sitting there looking at the camera, and on his lap are two pieces of bread, and he was making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and the photographer got this beautiful, it's sort of a shot of everyday life, and I remember showing it in the UK, and I said, okay, who's going to tell me what they see? And this young police officer raised his hand, and he said, well, it looks like one of your military men, and, you know, he's got a blank look on his face, and he's wearing camouflage, and I don't know what that mess is on his lap. And I thought, mess? I grew up on that mess. Like, that's peanut butter and jelly. Don't mess with peanut butter and jelly. But, you know, something that's so iconic to us in this country is not shared worldwide. And I thought, well, if that happens, what other cultural assumptions am I making, or are we all making, that we think people understand what's iconic to us and people just don't know what they're looking at? So it was kind of a wake-up call for me.
There's some remarkable stories that are told in this book, Fixed, and one of them is about Nike, which was really teetering at the edge in the 1970s. Their earnings had declined by 40%. They went to an ad agency in Portland and came up with this slogan, which has become iconic, Just Do It. But how they got there is an interesting story, isn't it?
It is. It is. And again, it shows you, or shows me, and shows all of us, the power of words, you know, and the association. Because when you said the word Nike and you talked about the Just Do It, what comes to mind is that swoosh, right? We all know what the Nike swoosh looks like. Of course, because it's just part of our world. And that slogan, as I was doing research into the book, two things. We all, well, those of us who are old enough to remember, Nancy Reagan's anti-drug campaign, Just Say No, you know, and even though people sort of scoffed and said, well, yeah, that's easy to say, it all stuck in our head because, you know, just say no. But this, the Nike slogan, Just Do It, people don't realize what a dark place it came from. Gary Gilmore, the killer, he was scheduled to die. I believe it was by execution. And people were, you know, held vigils outside the prison and said, no, don't kill Gary Gilmore. And his last wish was to be killed. He said, you know, I deserve to die. And what he said was, when they put the hood over his head and the firing squad was facing him, he said, just do it, or let's do this. And it was just this, you know, these bracing words that nobody ever thinks of the Nike slogan associated with the execution of a killer.
But
you know, let's do this.
That's how it happened.
That's how it happened. Yes. And so, you know, people have said to me, well, does it matter where things come from? I think it does. You know, we live in such an ephemeral world. We live in things pass us so quickly. I think it's important for us to know where things come from. And it just solidifies or anchors our connection to the world.
Well, the book is Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving, from Amy Herman. And you sound like a journalist. We're short on time, but journalists are told to go the four W's, and there you are, promoting the who, what, when, where, and why. That's five W's, but who, when, where, and why. Why are those important in any kind of problem solving?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, we have so many problems facing, from, you know, kids learning remotely to just negotiating to get around Omicron, and we're facing all kinds of problems. And I really wanted to give people a template that is useful for all of them. We have enough on our plate. I don't want to give you things to memorize, but to sort of bake into our infrastructure, how can we look at things differently? How can we think about problems differently? And one of the biggest takeaways I want people to have from this book is, don't let perfection be the enemy of good. Sometimes good is good enough, and don't strive for perfection. Let's solve the problems where we can and move on to the next one to try to make our lives better.
Well, the book, again, is Fixed, and it is a spectacular-looking book with lots of pertinent information, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Thank you so much, Amy. Congratulations.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Good weekend.
First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Stay safe. Stay tuned.